Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tomorrow, I am platinum. Born the year of the Nazi invasion of Russia in June 1941 and Pearl Harbor in December, virtually smack between both. I remember once, many years ago, a cocktail waitress who examined my ID said that she and I were born on the same day, August 19th, 1941. I flippantly said I was born general delivery in a Los Angeles public hospital. She said she was born in a Nazi slave labor camp in Poland. The day I struck gold in 1991, Boris Yeltsin stood on a tank in Moscow and upstaged the world's attention to my 50th birthday by thwarting a final spasm of the evil empire. The day I was silver, I spelunked through a gold mine. I spent my 25th birthday, which was 50 years ago, on a reconnaissance patrol in the mountains of South Vietnam, north of Chu Lai, up near the DMZ. We were looking for a suspected Viet Cong hospital in a hollowed-out mountain known to Vietnamese as Nui Kem that had once been the most extensive and apparently richest gold mine in French Indochina. If we had found a hospital, we would have marked it for destruction by airstrikes and infantry, contrary to rules of warfare doctrines, and we might have had to do some immediate damage to get out alive. Seven of us spent the day prowling through a huge complex of tunnels and shafts burrowed into the mountain by thousands of obviously indentured Vietnamese during the days of French colonialism. We were armed with pistols, flashlights, and a scout dog, and hauled with us what seemed several miles of cord line so that we could find our way back out. We found the mine entrance by chance on my birthday after a couple of days of searching for it, a small hole that seemed to breathe from inside the mountain. It was concealed among overgrown rubble left when the French bombed the mine to prevent the victorious Viet Minh from finding it a dozen years earlier. The entire mountain seemed honeycombed with large tunnels. We were able to explore only a few levels near the bottom. I felt like Tom Sawyer looking for Injun Joe, but we found nothing except a few spectral-like footprints in some shafts and mysterious handprints on dusty rocks in huge caverns. That night, as we camped out next to the mountain, near a stream that coursed through the valley, we thought we were under attack by Viet Cong battalions rumored to be in neighboring valleys. Our attackers turned out to be a very thirsty howler monkey tribe we had chased away from water when we entered the valley a few days earlier. We were vastly relieved and slightly unhinged when we discovered they were only a horde of monkeys as they swept past us toward the stream. I returned to the United States on my 26th birthday the following year. A small Marine Corps band awaited us at the pier in San Diego with a few friends and families of Marines and sailors aboard the ship that brought us home. The band was a tawdry, ragged collection of jarheads in disheveled uniforms, playing military marches half-heartedly and off-key. I thought of the ticker tape parades and crowds of thousands who greeted returning veterans from the world wars, and in comparison, looking at the tepid welcome we received, I was more than aware that Vietnam was a second-class war. Of course, we were only a single shipload of survivors in an early year of the Vietnam War, but the rest of the war only confirmed my opinion. I have written somewhat of a memoir of my homecoming and its aftermath as a second-person narrative, which obviously demands a disclaimer that what you are about to hear in my scratchy voice today is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, anywhere, which includes all the ships at sea, in every sea, everywhere. Back home in the USA. All through his childhood, he lived in apprehension he would be caught up in a war, and his sense of its inevitability resulted in a belief that he would most likely, most certainly, be killed. He had much precedent to feed his premonition. He was born a few months before Pearl Harbor, a fat, happy American baby, unaware that hundreds of thousands of babies and children were being killed and crippled all over the world. Afterwards, the interminable years of a Cold War that threatened worldwide nuclear obliteration while he was growing up. Duck and cover was the dire mantra of his childhood. So when there was a war in Vietnam, he accepted it as the war of his generation. He inevitably volunteered for it as a U.S. Marine. Consumed with a pervasive self-prophecy of doom, he knew his short life was rooted on its inevitability. So he went to war, and to his immense surprise, survived without harm. And as utterly as the conjecture of war preoccupied the early part of his life, its stark reality structured everything afterward. He would never understand why he had lived through his one-year combat tour, any more than he would grasp why persons near him were shot dead or blown apart somewhat farther away from him by mortars or landmines. Yet he was never hit. Fresh from Vietnam, he cherished every day as unexpected and undeserved. That sharp sense of exhilaration, coupled with sorrow for dead friends and guilt for having survived when they did not, especially since he had been so sure he would not, had dulled over the decades. Yet he rarely took for granted he would be alive at the end of every day he awakened. He balanced, somewhat paradoxically, his appreciation that he continued to live with increased awareness of having used up his 70. Each day was a rebirth, but also a day closer to the crypt. His spool was running out faster the less time remaining to unravel. Now, when he glimpsed into the future, his attention was concentrated on his corpse, sprawled somewhere up near the near timeline. For him, Vietnam was the war. Of all the wars, it had been the war he was in, only for a year. But it beamed through his brain afterward with the clarity of a laser, surrounded by the rest of his years, which were muddled in comparative amnesia. He found it difficult to see through the bloody prism of the war to his earlier life. He saw an estranged apparition moving opaquely through a dimly remembered history he knew was his own, yet was discontinuous with the person who emerged from the war. The war was his fault line, and the parts of it bifurcated did not quite match up. He felt the portion of him on the opposite side of the margin would not have much to say he would now be interested in. Vietnam, the war, as distinguished from the country, was always immediate in his mind, despite its disappearance into the shadows of collective memory. The war was as distant to the young generations born afterward as the myths of Armageddon. Vietnam veterans were grandparents and generally close-mouthed about the war with their families and friends who had not been in Vietnam. Among themselves, they chattered like crows. Even if they seldom mentioned the war, it was their connective tissue against the rest of the world. He realized each carried the war like personal armor. Other wars appear and pass, generally dwarfing their predecessors in their rapid surge, sluicing away the immediacy of each. War veterans seemed like old ghosts, unable to separate themselves from their vanished separate wars. He knew people were disappointed with Vietnam vets, not so much because the war was lost, but because it had undone so many of them. He thought his life after Vietnam had taken on the quality of an unsettled dream he might have had while he was still there. A displacement of what the war had shown him to be serious and real, but was of little use since. The paradox of surviving the war was that, obsessed by the war, he found it difficult to accept seriously the daily life he had lived since. More times than he could count, he was asked how he was able to make the transition from war to reality. The real question was how to make his post-war life real. That even after half a century, his life was still not real to him. The war was his real life. Everything else felt counterfeit. Back from the war, he discovered his reflexes had outlasted their necessity, as though everything afterward were an illusion. He flinched and nearly dropped to his belly when cars or trucks backfired or firecrackers erupted. Once he threw a woman down on a sidewalk when his foot brushed something he mistook for a booby trap tripwire. He might walk on a spring day in an open field, admiring budding trees and smelling flowers. A moment later, a helicopter might fly over, and he would be instantly back in the war, looking intently for armed enemies among trees and bushes. He was angry and anguished by his close experience with death and horror for a year, a much shorter period of time than others at their various wars, but excessively more than enough for him. Others saw more combat, and he felt lucky the worst of it escaped him. Yet the war was iridescently the most vivid and climactic part of his life. It sculpted his attitude toward life and people, and he knew the essential dividing line between him and them. Those who experienced war, however lightly, and those who hadn't. He learned more about the reality of human relations in war than he probably would any other way, and though he had experienced little of combat compared to many others, he wished for no more of it. Everyone he knew in Vietnam had their own private, intensely personal war, and if they survived, they won the war, even though the larger war was lost. Vietnam was the nucleus of his life, as if both his birth and death were outer rings of less consequence. One sunset, in a sky baroque with operatic clouds, a beam of memories sliced through him like a laser, a desperate pitched ball of hope sent into the future for him to catch by a very scared, much younger him, preparing for another long night in Viet Cong jungles and rice fields, projecting a beam of fervent desire that he would survive the night and all other nights he was in the war and be alive to receive the sharp ray from the past, which, at that moment, transmuted time and momentarily connected the bifurcated parts of him. The war was an open wound, not because his experiences were so terrible, but what he helped inflict upon Vietnamese. While many veterans did what they could to ease their memories through drugs and drink, he used them as a means to remember the war without going too crazy. He wished to be a conscience because he thought someone must, somewhat like a guilt-stricken American soldier he had heard about who wandered Hiroshima's radioactive streets atoning for the atom bomb. He knew his feelings had no place in opulent, frenzied America, except among a few. But he was unable to change because he wouldn't allow himself to change. He seemed frozen in a moment long past, a war of a previous century and millennium, but for him unresolved, despite the acceleration past remorse and shame by the society that perpetrated it as a caustic matter of policy. He refused to allow the victims of the war, American and Vietnamese, Laotian, Cambodian, etc., to disappear into memory's dustbin. Some might have said he never recovered from the war, but the recovery they meant would have him stop thinking about the murder of Vietnamese, and he refused to recover from that. He would never forget he had helped define genocide to Vietnamese. It was his shining, contrary icon, and now it seemed more important than ever to shine that crippled beacon upon those who conceived similar genocides, in particular, a millennial insanity that seemed to unravel on a global scale. He remembered his very small part of the war as a series of contradictory fragments, flashbacks of exhilaration, horror, and incessant dread that not only permeated his body and being, but which also became his accustomed companion to such a degree he was virtually unconscious of it. The war taught him to live in the moment, which he still did, though perhaps not as ardently as when he measured his life in seconds, at the most, minutes. He had lived in the now, aware the next instant he might be dead, wounded, or inexplicably unscathed until the next shot or explosion. His war reached no further than the narrow butchery of a daily routine of annihilation. Then his time was up, and he was out of the war. A ship's voyage back to the States and discharge. He often thought it strange to return from a war that was not over, would in fact continue for many more years. He had hoped to survive with his entire being, yet in memory he was always going back to the war, although behind everything was the knowledge that his war memories ended with his survival. The war was his moment, and it was gone. Or more truthfully, he was gone from it. It might have been best if he had not left it, or like so many vets, among them friends, opted out afterward rather than endure a dissembled, incomplete, and desolate continuance. Sometimes he felt the substance of himself died in Vietnam. Only a skeletal facade remained. He sleeplessly dreamed he was perpetually stuck in Vietnam. His real experiences were in his waking thoughts, triggered by noises, smells, sudden movements. His dreams were delusional time loops of inescapable horridness, trapped at war over and over again. He felt that a large crowd of dead young men waited for his return to their company. Even half a century later, he knew he would not escape the war. It waited in ambush to finally booby-trap and kill him. Emotions he froze to survive reappeared when the horror was past, and in relative safety afterward, he involuntarily relived terrors he had suppressed, the frantic moments they would have destroyed him if he had allowed them to form. Yet he savored living despite his estimation he was one of the walking dead. His definition of success was breathing. He lived one pointless day to the next, not at all worried that there was probably no real meaning to anything. He was satisfied that he was alive in the world and that he was brain and flesh to think and feel. He knew he was fortunate that he was not killed or crippled in Vietnam. He thought often of friends who were killed and wondered what had become of others who lived, what their post-Vietnam lives had been like, how many died in the intervening years. He was an old man remembering a young man's intensity of impending death incoming at any moment, knowing the bitter truths and deceits behind his revulsion for the war, and most importantly, knowing who its real victims were. Innocents killed, raped, crippled, tortured, for no greater reason that they were there, in itself grotesquely sinister. He felt outside. He had experienced that which most people did not wish to speak about or be informed about, however much they publicly glorified it. The facts of his life were of little interest, and the profundity of what he had learned was of no importance to those whose lives flowed daily around his own. Underlying everything else, he knew with certainty that he should never have gone to Vietnam. He had no right to participate in the killing of other human beings. When he thought or talked about war, he was not concerned with geopolitical aspects, but with the persons directly involved as he had once been, the ciphers of little meaning or consequence to any but themselves and the few close to them. For him, the consequences were personal. The killers and the killed, the shattered lives of ordinary persons destroying each other in the grips of forces they were unable to ignore or mediate, even between themselves. He felt that his survival of the war only set him up for a huge cosmic joke, but perhaps his survival was the joke. He felt conflicting feelings of happiness at being home alive, and upset at the diffidence and resentment with which he was greeted by others who had not gone to Vietnam. Like a cop at a party, as a Vietnam vet, he was regarded with hostile embarrassment. During the many long years the war dragged on after his return from Vietnam, he felt he narrowly skirted mental breakdown because he knew that every day the war continued, Americans and Vietnamese were dying, and each day he and others urgently spent attempting to stop the war, they were rebuffed by a stone wall of disapproval and malignant patriotism. Patience was the shibboleth of both those for and against the war, whose concerns were more about the outcome than the costs. More than once he wished to opt out, to disappear, but the only alternative was eventual suicide, and he didn't want to go there. Too many of his friends, who had fought so desperately to live through the war, surrendered to suicide once back home because of a combination of mental and moral breakdown that affected most who survived the war to various degrees. He saw a shrink a few times. The shrink thought the war was behind his psychic pain. Of course it was. If you don't come back from a war crazy, you're really crazy, he said. He wondered if the shrink's purpose was to soften reality for his patients or help them regain strength to struggle with it. Fighting through his despair would not involve rehabilitation, but rebellion. He wished to live quietly in a noisy world. He was in no hurry while virtually everyone around him skittered in high gear. His culture raced past like a rabbit. He shuffled rather than sprinted, reluctant to surrender the past, wishing he could bore into it like a worm into a womb. He was not rash enough to fling himself off a bridge or shoot off the top of his head. He preferred a slower suicide, erosion of spirit and purpose. His fierce opposition to the war was partly justification for quitting it when he had the chance, instead of extending for a second tour. He had used up his luck and was certain a second tour would be fatal. He had given the war and the USMC ample opportunity to kill or cripple him. He might feel survivor guilt, deserting friends who would remain in Vietnam. Obvious proof of his not doing enough was his survival, but he was not a fool, nor were most of his friends who rudely congratulated him for his good luck of survival, with fervent expressed hopes of reaching their own deliverance dates. Yet he had been sickened at what he had helped bring upon Vietnamese and the cynical cruelty that impelled it. It did not take much persuasion for him to become an anti-war activist, and he believed he would have been, even if Vietnam Veterans Against the War had not existed. He felt a deep responsibility for his involvement in the war, despite the urging of stateside friends to put it aside and move on with his life. He had participated in something he regarded as dreadfully wrong and wished to make amends in some useful manner. It seemed to be up to those like him to attempt undoing what they had done, even if they had had no choice, because he knew he had a choice, even if it meant disgrace or death. There it was. You ride history, or it rides you. He had turned irrevocably against the Vietnam War, but even his stance for peace was grim and warlike, and his experience against the war was for the most part violent, although he was generally on the receiving end of the violence perpetrated by police and National Guard units. He got beat up by cops, maced, tear-gassed, and arrested all around the country while organizing veterans and participating in anti-war demonstrations. At first, he had believed people would ultimately listen to the soldiers who fought the war rather than the incessant propaganda by the stay-at-home war hawks. He was wrong. He and the other combatants who publicly turned against the war were denounced as traitors, worse than hippies and draft resistors, even as cowards. More sympathetic person said to him, "You can't stop war." He replied, "It stops with me." He might also say, "A majority begins with one." He wondered if anyone would form groups of reenactors for Vietnam as they had for the Revolution, Civil War, and World War II. How would they restage the abrupt and usually brief firefights? He once half-jokingly suggested to a friend, also a Vietnam vet, that they go back to Vietnam and be reenactors, paid like mercenaries to portray imperialist, ugly Americans shot and killed every day in mock battles by heroic NVA or NLF soldiers, better yet, by women Viet Cong. He almost laughingly thought the only place in the world he might feel safe was Vietnam. A Vietnamese woman whose entry into the United States had been married to an American diplomat at the Saigon embassy asked him to concisely define his war experience in Vietnam. "Rambo and Goldilocks," he replied. He said he assaulted countless villages with other Marines, deja vu villages, he called them. Most of the time, villagers fled at their entrance, while other Marines searched the villages for incriminating evidence of Viet Cong activity. He explored inside the mud and straw-thatched huts for whatever meals had been hastily abandoned on tables. He carried a USMC-issued spoon wherever he went and used it to sample the orphaned food. A young girl once asked him if he was scared in Vietnam. He said he was terrified in his first firefight and wanted to run away, and that it never changed. His first thought every time was to run away. His greater fear was that if he did run, the Viet Cong would most likely be where he ran to. He had been so scared in Vietnam, he said, that he half wished to die so as not to be afraid anymore. His mother had told him before he left for Vietnam that the only war crime that would cause her to disown him as her son would be using his position as an armed soldier to rape a woman or a girl, a threat she had never made before. He followed her admonition and afterward told her and friends that he had not adhered to military codes of conduct, various Geneva Accords, Nuremberg mandates, or any of the other rules of warfare doctrines. He obeyed his mother's law. His father's influence was more ironic. His father had been 4F during World War II, and while growing up, he felt his father's presence as an outsider among war veterans. Many Marines he knew in Vietnam were there because their fathers had fought across the Pacific against Japan. He was there because his father had not been with their fathers. Now, half a century later, his war was lost in a fog of public amnesia and buried in the rubble of a dead millennium, alive only in the shadowed memories of its dwindling survivors, themselves vanishing into the sardonic dustbin of history. The clamor since 9/11 for patriotic unity gave him a sense of grim satisfaction rather than camaraderie. He no longer felt like a pariah. Friends didn't suggest he forget about Vietnam as they used to. Now they coyly asked him what war was really like and mockishly thanked him for his service, to which he generally responded that Vietnamese would not thank him. A succession of newer wars convulsed the country since 9/11. He wished he could stop them, stop the young who would kill and die before they had much of a chance to explore the new century. He thought he and the other old vets obsessed with their past wars should take the place of the young men and women and finally die in the combat they had initially survived, but which had deadened them. Why not save the young and finally do something long postponed? He knew that was unreal, that he would never go to war again, only grieve for those who would. He remembered just before he boarded ship for Vietnam, a World War II Marine he had known most of his life and thought him a fool for volunteering for the war, tried to tell him how to stay alive. He felt there wasn't much he could say to the fresh recruits for slaughter, and nothing he would have to say to the survivors afterward. My venerable friend and esteemed professor of both history and ivories, an ancient term for piano of which he is a jazz impresario, David Horowitz, turned platinum yesterday, August 17th. Happy birthday today to Judy Nyland, Mother Superior of Shanghai and Astoria, and to Julie, whose birth name conception reflects the world's ecstatic hope for renewal the day she was born, August 14th, 1945, the day humanity's most terrible war stopped. I dedicate today's program. This has been Michael McCusker.